KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Elmwood, Berkeley.
I live in the Haight.
North-ish, Oakland.
I live in the Western Addition.
Lake Merritt.
The Twin Peaks.
Coming up, everything you ever wanted to know about Lake Merritt.
If we were to call it in a historically correct way, it would be Lagoon Merritt or Slow Merritt.
Then we'll hear about some of the lake's lesser-known residents.
What was that? They swam out to the middle of the lake where the lake is like 9 feet deep. When they got there, it wasn't a human. It was a spirit.
And we'll learn how walking around the jewel of Oakland inspired the musician known as Toon Yards.
There was something about the rhythm of my walking and the rhythm of that phrase that, no water in the water fountain, that just like came out of that.
Where the city meets the water's edge, today on Cross Currents. Names can be misleading. Peanuts are not nuts, for example, but legumes. Koala bears are not actually bears. They're marsupials. So what about Oakland's so-called Lake Merritt? Is a lake really what it is? That's what one of our listeners asked us through our project Hey Area. That's where you ask the questions and we find the answers. To do just that, here's KALW's Jürgen Klemm.
Lake Merritt is actually not a lake. This body of water was originally a tidal slough, or a tidal lagoon, as it has been and still is, connected to the salty ocean water of the bay. If we were to call it in a historically correct way, it would be Lagoon Merritt or Slough Merritt, or maybe even the Ohlone Slough, because the Ohlone people were the first ones to settle this swampy area. Fishing and hunting were several creeks emptied into what we today call the San Francisco Bay. The recorded history of Lake Merritt begins in the 1810s, when the local natives were removed to Mission San Jose, and the estuary and its surrounding 45,000 acres became a ranch. With the gold rush, new settlers started squatting the area that's now downtown Oakland. Human population mushroomed on the shores of the lagoon, and former Ohlone fishing and hunting territory was turned into a sewage dump. In 1868, Oakland Mayor Dr. Samuel Merritt decided to remake the lagoon into a symbol of civic pride. The sewage was directed to the bay, and a dam was built along 12th Street. The water attracted a lot of migratory birds, along with a lot of hunters. Locals soon grew tired of gunfire in their neighborhood, and in 1870, Lake Merritt became the first wildlife sanctuary in North America. And thanks to Dr. Samuel Merritt, it's not only a sanctuary for birds, but also Oaklanders.
What local mysteries are rankling you? Head to KALW.org and type your question into the Hey Area box. The lake that is not a lake has also been known as the jewel of Oakland. When the sun sets, you can really see why. A string of 3,400 pearly light bulbs begin to glow. And rumor has it there's something else that likes to come out at night.
My name is Robert Weiner, and what I asked was whether it's true that Lake Merritt in Oakland's necklace of lights was installed because of complaints about ghosts.
That was another question asked through our Hey Area project. We sent KALW's Geraldine Asu to find out more, and it turns out there's more than one ghost story on the shores of Lake Merritt.
Do you believe in ghosts? Word around the lake is people have been seeing some things.
Oh, I've seen things, and yeah, we hear things, right? Definitely some things that people don't know about.
That's Dr. Richard Bailey, founder and former director of the Lake Merritt Institute. He's been hanging around the lake for more than 20 years, so he's no stranger to its secrets.
A long time ago, there was a mermaid called Miska. And she was out in the lake. It was cold. It was winter. Darkness had come early. Strong waves pushed the winter wind onto the concrete shoreline. Miska was very sad.
As the story goes, in her sadness, Miska went to visit her friend, Jonathan the Seagull. Things weren't going so well in Oakland. Garbage was accumulating around the lake, and people were losing their homes.
But just then they heard a loud splash, interrupted by a muffled cry. Oh, wait, that was no fish, said Miska. What was that? They swam out to the middle of the lake, where the lake is like 9 feet deep. When they got there, it wasn't a human, it was a spirit. Who are you? Shouted Miska.
If you've ever been to the lake, you're probably wondering how its water even supports bird life, let alone mermaid life. With 62 storm drains and 8 creeks dumping their water into what's essentially a tidal lagoon that we call a lake, it's no wonder there's some funk. But anyway, back to these ghosts.
To be frank, I had never heard the ghost story before. That's a new one for me.
That's Diana Osterberg, treasurer of the Lake Merritt Breakfast Club. They're the stewards of the lights. Every Thursday, the club meets at the crack of dawn, when the lake is quiet and the morning mist is still lingering. Inside the meeting, though, the room is alive.
Welcome to another meeting of the Lake Merritt Breakfast Club. Sponsors of Children's Fairyland and the Necklace of Lights.
The Necklace of Lights is the combination of lampposts and the string of bulbs, which together line the lake's 3.4-mile perimeter. I asked Osterberg what she knows about why the lights were strung around the lake.
Well, we could start at the beginning. The inspiration for the original Necklace of Lights was really a meeting in 1922 that was held by the Shriners in Lakeside Park.
The Shriners are a social club that started out in the late 1800s. By the 1920s, their membership had grown, and they established a temple right next to Lake Merritt.
The city fathers wanted to do something to let the Shriners know that they were really welcomed and appreciated. So some enterprising Oaklanders erected some poles and got some colored lights and strung them the 3+ miles around the lake just to welcome the Shriners. It caught on so greatly, everybody loved it, that the idea came that they would like to see a permanent installation.
So that's why these lights were first strung up.
It had a magical appearance to it, and that really caught their attention. And there was also the feeling of patriotism. Definitely, you know, as when we entered World War II.
The lights shined bright until 1941. But then during wartime, the U.S. government imposed blackout restrictions, which kept the lights off for decades to come. In 1982, the lights were resurrected by a woman named Emmeline K. Jewett, daughter of local icon William K. Noland of the Oakland Tribune.
She said, I dream of having the Necklace of Lights lit once again.
When the lights go on again, all over the world.
Hearing the call, the Lake Merritt Breakfast Club led the way in reestablishing the Necklace of Lights. In 1987, they were finally able to restore the lights, and the reintroduction was magical.
All the lights were extinguished, all the city lights. It was total darkness, which you don't see in a city very often. And then, bam, the lights came on. This whole crowd went, like, just gasping. It was so incredible.
When the lights go on again, all over the world.
So while the Necklace of Lights doesn't appear to have been established to ward off ghosts, it's still nice to imagine that Miska the Mermaid and Jonathan the Seagull are dancing in the lake when they think no one's watching. Do you believe in ghosts? In Oakland, I'm Geraldine Asu.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane in for Hanat Baba. For our next story, we're going to stay near the waters of Oakland's Lake Merritt. That's where one local but world-touring musician dreamt up her song, Water Fountain. We'll let her introduce herself.
My name is Meryl Garbus, and I make music under the name Toon Yards. Nate Brenner is a co-writer on most of the songs now that Toon Yards creates. it was January of 2013, and I was like, okay, it's the new year, and now I'm going to start to make a new album. And so I kind of forced myself into this routine where I'd go into my little studio, which was a shipping container that had been made into a little rehearsal studio. So I was there in this like super hot metal box, sitting at a computer and trying to make all these demos. So I'd been taking a lot of walks around Oakland, and I was walking around Lake Merritt, which is just down the street from where we live. And I would just walk around that lake a whole lot and passing water fountains, some of them working, some of them not working. And, you know, at that time I was hearing stuff about conservatives not wanting to pay taxes. And I just kind of let my brain wander, like, you know, what if no one ever paid taxes? And what if no one ever decided that it was worth it to put money into our greater good? Seeing that through my imagination that, you know, no roads, no sidewalks, no water fountains. I don't know. There was something about the rhythm of my walking and the rhythm of that phrase that no water in the water fountain that just like came out of that. The lyric and the melody and the sing-songiness of it and the topic of it, I think all came bundled up into one. When Tune Yards began, I was really interested in rhythm being a huge part of that. I just am super obsessed with the interplay between rhythms and this creation of a greater rhythmic whole when you have these multiple rhythmic voices going on at the same time. So the 3-2. And the other 2-3. And that was me, you know, in the hot box, just layering claps over one over another and just saying, okay, that's a start to something. And then I kind of would just hear what was missing, like where can I fill in even more gaps between those two clapping parts? And what I came up with was this that 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 ba ba da ba da. So it's really those three rhythms laid over each other. I love when things are human and not machine-like, obviously, as anyone listening to this music would know. It is not perfect by any means, but there's a tipping point at which I go, nope, I was a little bit too off the beat there for use in a song that I really wanted to be a dance song. The story of this song is basically that I almost threw it away because I thought it was dumb. It just sounded like really simple. I mean, think about me spending hours trying to work out laying my claps over one another and then coming up with the words like no wood in the Woodstock.
No wood in the Woodstock.
What the hell does that mean? And I was like, this is so annoying and I'm annoying and everything sucks. And Nate had a hot box across from mine and he would walk over every afternoon. It would be like a sanity check. And I'd be like, this sucks. And he'd be like, no, no, it's cool. And he came in and he played the first bass line that comes in. And I thought rhythmically his bass line was awesome, but I thought, no, it sounds too right. Like if you play in that kind of major key, then it's gonna sound too right and it needs to sound a little bit more wrong. We kind of fought about it a little bit in our peaceful way. And then he came up with if he's playing in minor. And all of a sudden, the color of the song completely changes. And that was really important to me, that the things that this song was talking about to me were really heavy. And so it didn't make sense to just keep the whole song in major. It was like, this is disturbing. That's kind of where he was like, well, how about this? And I was like, how about that? And then we were like, okay, both.
I saved up all my pennies and I gave them to this special guy. When he had enough of them, he bought himself a cherry pie. He gave me a dollar, a blood-soaked dollar. I cannot get the spot out, but it's okay. It still works in the store.
It's still this pretty simple major melody, but then you just make the bass line minor. And all of a sudden, it's like the stomach churning part of the song where all of a sudden you know that something's gonna go down.
Then your fingers through my hair, fingers through my hair. Give me a dress, give me a press. I'll give a thing a caress. Would you listen to the ones I said? Sound.
You know, now there are a lot of people involved in Tune Yards, the record label and our manager, and they're like, this is it, man. This is the single, this is the catchy one. can you please just make it less dissonant? And I was like, no, I really can't. I mean, Tuneyard started when I was listening to a ton of dancehall reggae. And there's something about the tradition of reggae that for so many reasons, there is this dissonance and this kind of dub sensibility where there are things that feel wrong or don't link up exactly, but there's so much implied in that disagreement between elements. There's some reggae albums where you feel like the singer came in and sang and couldn't hear the track. And then the track that they end up putting underneath the singer is like a totally different song with a different key.
Murder's wrong. Murder she wrote.
Action all with him. A pretty face and bad character. Then they kind of live in town. Old chaka.
So I love that sense of wrong parts put together, but then when it comes back together as a whole, it has this whole different conversation of wrongness. You know, no water in the water fountain is, it's like a horrible concept, even more so now in California. But in 2013, too, we were talking about the drought. And it was terrifying to me to allow my imagination to go that far and think of life without water coming out of your taps. You know, even just talking about these things now, it's like this really uncomfortable tension in my stomach. And I think that's the feeling that I love to evoke in songs, where I'm not writing pretty songs for people to fall in love to necessarily. I'm writing songs that sound more like the truth of the world to me. And that has to mean that that's literally built into the song. That's literally built into the harmonies or the friction or that grating sense of the song. And that's kind of why, I don't know, I was listening to that drum machine stem, and at first it's got the cute little cowbell sound, and then throughout the song, as you get to the end of the song, it's like this crazy distorted mess of a drum machine. I found this awesome water bottle at a thrift store, and it's just like these things that kind of fit into the world of the song, like spare parts kind of sounds. Like a water bottle just evokes water somehow. Even if you're not saying, oh, it's a water bottle, there's just something about it that's like, yep, that fits in. So this is where the brilliant John Hill comes in, because he introduced the laser sound. Now, we were so nervous working with other producers, and I'm very possessive of the term producer because I feel like, you know, I am my own producer. But we took the song in at the request of some of our label people and played it for John Hill, who's worked on a lot of cool stuff. Rihanna and MIA. And so he had those lasers for us. And I played those lasers on a sample pad with a stick. So we all agreed that that was, again, another dance hall element that amps up the song when it's like, and now the lasers come in. You know what it is? Oh my gosh. That's just me and my voice and my tongue making some crazy roll in there. But then sampled and played on a keyboard. So that we did with John Hill as well. We sampled my voice and then I was able to play it on a MIDI triggering keyboard, and I could play chords with my own voice doing that crazy gurgly noise. I am so captivated by music. The ability to speak without words. The sound itself is telling the story, and it's kind of like a big puzzle that even I am trying to figure out. It's so fun. Recording is amazing.
Nowhere.
That piece was produced by Rishikesh Irway for the podcast Sound Exploder. All of the episodes are just as good as that one, so check them out. There's a link on our website, kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. We've spent today learning all about the water at the heart of Oakland, and we realized we couldn't do a whole show about Lake Merritt without talking about the geese. Geese flock to the bird sanctuary, especially in summer months. In this piece from our archives, reporter Tiffany Kamhai meets some of the folks who work right alongside the birds.
My name is Kevin Jones. I'm a recreation aide at Lake Merritt Boating Center.
Hold the boat!
What does Lake Merritt mean to you?
I just love being out on the water, getting to view the lake. It brings up a lot of memories. I used to come around here with my dad when I used to live in the area. And just seeing a lot of crazy stuff, like people falling in boats and stuff. And
so do the wildlife, do the geese ever get in the way of the boaters?
No, I think we get in their way a lot. I don't know. Yeah, they're characters. They should watch for their poop, I guess, if I could say that. I like them. It's characteristic of Lake Merritt. Whenever you think of it, you think of the bird.
I'm James Robinson. I teach sailing here. I also come up with program curriculums. And I also work for the Lake Merritt Institute, which goes around and educates the public on urban runoff.
Any of the boaters complain about the geese, or do you have any complaints about the geese?
We have a lot of complaints about the geese. At one point, someone suggested us getting this service called the Goose Busters, where these little dogs run around and harass the geese until they fly off. But since this is the oldest wildlife refuge in North America, Stephanie at the Rotary Nature Center was having no part of that.
So my name is Stephanie Benavides. I'm the supervising naturalist for the city of Oakland. This wildlife refuge, through no fault of its own, had a city built around it and urban sprawl. And so part of the problem is trying to balance the wildlife refuge with recreational needs of the public. During the migratory season, which is right now the summer season, they migrate here and they molt. That's why you see the guys sweeping. There's a lot of feathers on the ground. And so they're land bound between 4 to 6 weeks, so you can see all these feathers, to renew their flight feathers.
How many would you say are here now?
We get up to 1,000.
Is that just during the summer months?
During the summer months, yeah. Probably a complement of 300 in the off season. Yeah, a lot of people think they're obnoxious, but, you know, on a good day, this park will still be filled, and it'll still have people out on the lawn.
Oh, that's the amazing part. That's kind of like I didn't touch on that because it's obvious, but the wildlife is amazing. You can come down, sometimes see birds hunting fish on the side. You can see the pelicans that just come through on their migratory journey. It's amazing. Fish, birds. Hey, bring a sandwich, you got a whole day.
And that's it for our show. Today's production team includes Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Ted Muldoon, Stephen Short, Judy Silbert, Kuvalroop Singh, and Bowen Wang. The show is engineered by James Rollins. Line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. When it became apparent that Jerry Garcia had played his final show in 1995, Stu Allen, who you're hearing right now, took it upon himself to keep Garcia's music, sound, and spirit alive. And that's what Stu Allen and Mars Hotel will be doing Friday at the venerable Ashkenaz in Berkeley, continuing the tradition of Grateful Dead Night. Show starts at 8:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.